finally, the fire extinguisher most nearby is located in the corridor to the right of the dais as you leave the chamber. I hope that covers all necessary aspects of the safety briefing.
Yes, thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Better do it with a straight face next time.
And no hand signals? No.
Hand signals are important. I mean, if you're on the airplane.
I think they are, and they add a lot. Appreciated.
It's like a, is it? You sound like a PA system, Bob.
Just when the express train goes through, you can't hear it anyway.
All right, moving on. Work session topic, we're going to start with the Regional Street and Trail Design Guidelines. We've got Margie and Lake Matique. Did you take note on the safety briefing? I expect to hear that in every staff meeting.
Yes. Right. That's a hard act to follow. If you could record that, Councilor Stacey.
Wait, if we could just push a button, wouldn't have to do it. But.
President Peterson and members of the council, we are here today to talk about Metro's update of our urban design guidelines, also recalled our Livable Streets and Trails initiative. I want to open by giving a little bit of history and context, and then I'll turn it over to Lake to walk you through the PowerPoint. Metro has been leading on urban design since 1996. That was the first time that we published an urban design guideline. And at the time, it was really innovative, and a lot of people were looking to Metro to figure out how to do multimodal transportation and how to design for multimodal transportation. A lot of things have changed since that first guidelines. I'd say two important things. One, at all levels of government, but particularly at federal level of government, people have now recognized that you need to do context-sensitive design in urban areas and that you need to do multimodal design. And FHWA has recognized this in many ways through their policies and their updated design guidelines, as well as even ASHTO, which, you know, historically was more highway-focused, has allowed more flexibility in urban design context. So there's much more acceptance from and the trend is going that way to embrace urban design concepts. The other thing I wanted to talk about, which I think is different, is really this recognition that you need a laser focus on traffic safety, not public safety, while you're thinking about complete streets and designing streets. We now know that a design detail could be the difference in someone saving someone's lives. So we're looking at some of these design functions and saying, not only what makes a street livable and enjoyable, but what makes it safe. And I think that's the overlay and the lens in which this update was looked at. With that, and I know President Pearson has a lot of experience in this area, would you like to add anything in opening remarks?
You know, the level of detail that Metro has placed on this since 1996 comes down to the basics of traffic engineering 101, and that is that as you increase speed, the amount of access decreases. The more access points you have, the less efficient a facility will operate from a traffic engineering viewpoint, but it also creates all of these opportunities for side swipes, for T-bones, for rear-end collisions, running any kind of intersection and having accident. So from that standpoint, I guess I would just ask you all to remember, as we move more modes onto the same space, and we talk about how to allocate space within the right-of-way, what we're trying to do is clearly articulate to all users where they ought to be in order to be safe. And so between speed and the pavement marking and the allocation, it's a dance. And it's an important dance to have as a policy decision. For too long, this was an engineering decision, when in reality, it was a policy decision. Because there are too many things to trade off here, because we're not just trying to move as many vehicles through a pipe. right? That's not the goal in the urban areas. How fast are we moving vehicles through the pipe? So in order to have these trade-offs, we need to have the options, and those options are based on how you actually move different users through space. So I guess that's how I'd put it. And it depends on the land use that you're in.
Great. Council President Peterson and members of the council, my name is Lake McTighe, and I am a regional planner in the Planning and Development Department, and I've been working on this project to update our current street design guidelines. If you want a copy of our current ones, you're welcome. I can get them for you. And have been working on this project for a couple years now.
He just realized he's seen it.
I have seen that book.
You have seen this book, yes.
I still have it or not.
Yeah. A lot of people love this book. It's going to be one book now instead of three. And it'll be online and easily accessible. So, today I just want to make sure that for those of you that are not very familiar with this project, that you have a good understanding of it. And just to update you on where we're at. So we are in the midst of the project. These two images here on the slides are just, you can go to our website now, you can order copies of the current guide, and you can also go to our project webpage and learn about the update of the projects. As Margie mentioned, the guides were first developed in 1996, and they were last updated in 2002, and since that time there's been major changes, especially in transportation policy. We have a outcomes-based or performance-based framework for our regional transportation plan. We've adopted a climate smart strategy. We have a Vision Zero target. We have an active transportation plan and a freight plan, a transit strategy. So we have a lot of regional policy, and then as Margie mentioned, there's a lot of changes nationally in terms of how we think about streets, transportation, people, how they get around, that we really wanted the design guidance to be responsive and to those major changes and provide a useful tool to our partners across the region, agencies and organizations. Currently, and in the new guides, everything that we're including is allowable under national guidance provided by the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials, as well as the NACTO, the National Association of City Transportation Officials. So everything we're proposing is allowed. It's based on research and best practices, what's been proven to really achieve safety in terms of reducing and eliminating fatal and serious crashes, environmental and public health, all the things that we really care about.
Question.
Yes.
When you say it's allowed, I'm assuming that those standards you're talking about aren't laws. They're not requirements. But what you're saying is that what we're coming up with conforms to the recommendations or conforms to designs that they've identified as being useful or appropriate?
That's correct. Yeah, in engineering, in the world of transportation engineering, there's a wide range of tools out there, and engineers have a lot of leeway to identify the best solution to, meet the problems out there. Agencies will often say within that range, sort of say, this is what we think is the best thing to do.
I'll just add to that nowhere in federal statute or state statute are design guidelines dictated. The law is actually silent. What it is policy. There's different agency policies on which guidelines they use sometimes, and that's where you hear a difference of opinion.
So,
I think the important thing to know is that there is a standard. It's called the Green Book. It's put out by the American State. We just went through this.
Astro American Association of State
Highway Transportation Officials. But it's been around for a very long time, and what has happened is all 50 states have adopted very much more narrowed minimums and maximums, and I think Craig knows a lot about this. Sorry, Councillor Dirksen.
Sorry.
you're looking at me like, yep. But I think the thing to note is that after they narrowed all of their options, they've found that those options were too narrow for every context that you're in. So they've started widening them back out to what ASHTO actually recommended a long time ago. And so everything that is before you is actually within the ASHTO guidance.
Not just NACTO, but ASHTO.
Everything in NACTO is within the ASHTO guidance. And so I think that's important. It all goes back to that, but the ranges were very large because back in 1960s, they actually said the land uses are different. They actually recognized that. But the states, in order to put out a product that was exactly, almost the copy exactly, Intel methodology, so no matter what state you were in, it would look exactly the same. Your driver expectations were exactly the same. Your liability from their viewpoint would be the same. They narrowed it down so that the massive engineers out there were all doing the exact same thing.
We were building an interstate freeway.
We were building an interstate freeway, and we were doing it on time, under budget. So that doesn't mean every street in our network should look the same.
I sat in the back seat, my dad, mom in the front seat, when I-84 from the Oregon line toward the Dalles was a two-lane road, marked as an interstate freeway, because they were going to open before any other state the entire system, and they laid the two-lane stretch. So, yeah. ASHTO and I go way back.
So I will expand on this a little bit more further in the presentation, but just to sort of address what Council President Peterson was just saying, was that so while there's a wide range of flexibility, the design guides do provide a design approach. And so that is in order, that's been based on, you know, how to achieve the things that we want to achieve in our region, Vision Zero, increased multimodal, you know, people walking, biking, and taking transit. What are the types of street designs that we need? And so the guides do provide recommendations on within that range, what our consultants and our technical work group really think are the right approach to achieve that. So this timeline here is just really to show you, illustrate for you, that there's been quite a bit of work going into this project and has included really robust input from our agency and organization partners. So wherever you see a little box that says TPAC or MTAC or TWG, which is Technical Work Group, or Metro Council, you know, we've had input on our various pieces of work product. We actually started in our scoping by interviewing agency staff across the region, saying, what's useful in the guidelines? What would you like to see more of, different? And that has been really helpful in developing the scope. And then we took, I think, a really helpful approach in terms of identifying an annotated outline for the guide with the technical work group that we're now completing the work for. And that really helped everyone come to some agreement about what's going to be in the guide and what direction are we going to take for that. So we are now in final production. We're in the sort of we are here pink dot there. And we're now creating all the content, the images, the graphics, the tables. Everything's starting to look a little prettier. Right now it's still in draft and lots of bits and pieces. And this is just really to give you a sense of the types of agencies and organizations that have been involved in the technical work group, have been reviewing the work products and providing input. We have a very sort of detailed summary. We'll have get all of our comments, and then we'll respond in writing of how we're going to respond to the comments. So we have a really good documentation of the process overall. And we've had some excellent folks involved in the process and giving their technical expertise. So just now, the role of land use was mentioned and the importance of land use in transportation. And when the street design guidelines were first developed back in 1996, they were really revolutionary and were copied across the country and were really seen as sort of groundbreaking because they very explicitly acknowledge that transportation, the design of streets and how our transportation system functions really needs to serve the surrounding and planned land use. And that to achieve our 2040 growth concept, it's really important to look, you know, not every street in the region is going to look the same because not every place in the region looks the same. And the types of activities that you want to support in a certain area, the level of activity, you're going to design your street to help achieve that. Typically at the beginning of the last, in the last century, transportation sort of ignored land use, and it was just about motor vehicle mobility, and as a result, you often didn't get the types of land uses that you wanted. So these design guidelines are very, very much about implementing our land use vision, and what can we do to support that, whether it's a Main Street in Tigard, or downtown Oregon City, or the central city, or a corridor like TV Highway that serves, has its own types of use. So what do we need to do to support that? Within the regional transportation plan, we have this map, and I did, knowing that it's always really hard to see things on slides, I did print out some of the graphics in sort of a larger format, so you can check that out. But this is our regional transportation design classifications. It's adopted regional policy in the regional transportation plan. It's basically the network of throughways and arterials, this one right here. And this is this classification not only acknowledges the sort of volume of cars and the speed of car or autos traveling on that roadway, but also thinks about what land use is it traveling through today, or what is our planned land use for it? What are we trying to achieve in that area? So the design classifications are extremely high-level design guidance. For each one of these design classifications, whether it's freeway, highway, regional boulevard, regional street, community boulevard or community street, or industrial street, it provides some guidance on what are the number of lanes typically for that facility, for that design classification, what are the priority functions. So, for example, a throughway like I-205, the priority functions would be auto mobility, freight mobility, sometimes transit mobility, and we're moving into a direction of more, even more of that. Whereas in your boulevard, your main priority functions would be transit access, bike and ped access, and so you sort of look at how is the transportation facility supporting those different priority functions. We also provide high-level guidance on the design speed, and we're moving towards slower speeds overall in the region to help achieve our safety targets. Separation of modes. So, for example, on a highway like 224, you would want complete separation of people walking and biking. You do not want that integrated on the highway. Whereas on a and separation modes is very much about the speed of the cars. So if you have higher speeds, you're going to want more separation, more buffers for people walking, such as trees or parked cars. So this provides a very high-level snapshot of what type of design guidance we want to have. And this graphic, which is also provided in your handout just so you can get a little closer up, this is still draft, but this is really, it's called a transect. It's sort of a new urbanism type visual, but it really is shown, it's really to show the reader how our land use typologies are tied to our regional street design typologies, and how, as in this sort of schematic, a street is going to change as the land use around it is changed, the planned land use or and the existing land use. It's going to change in width. It's going to change in whether you're going to have a boulevard design or not, width of the sidewalks, etc. So you want to respond to that, and so that really when you're in a place, it's like the street just feels very intuitive because it really fits the land use.
The narrative descriptions under each of these categories struck me as underwhelming in terms of the presumed scale of adjoining development. Main streets are commercial strips along major streets with 1 to 3 story buildings for employment and housing. And there are few buildings being built at less than three stories on streets like Division and Hawthorne today. I know that's decried by many as the coming apocalypse, but it seems to be entirely consistent with the way those streets function, and I wonder if we need to update the narrative descriptions along with other work.
Bob, what section was that? Sorry.
Was
that town centers or?
In the dark blue.
For what vertical column?
The Main Streets column is what I was reading from, but you can see similar language under
more stories.
Under town centers, you're talking about 1 to 3 story buildings in town centers. And, one story buildings will continue to be built, but I would think the range at least should be larger.
Mm-hmm.
And one story buildings are built everywhere, so you don't need to call them out.
It's in the graphic.
Excellent, yes.
Is that where it is? Is that what you're talking about, the graphic?
Yeah.
This sheet. If you look at the
it is reflected in
the graphic.
Graphic.
Okay, thank
as
you.
Well.
So, thank you. That's a great comment.
Above, I see. Yeah, yeah.
And that's a good catch. We actually have already changed them somewhat. I've been working with Tim O'Brien and Ted Reed because I know we're looking at the 2040 refresh. So there's already been some, based on kind of what's already happening out there, some update along the lines of that. And I'm happy to share that new language.
I mean, even downtown like Oswego didn't go to 6, but they did go to 5.
Yes. Thank you. That's really wonderful input. So we've talked about safety, and I'm sorry, I don't know why that little buffered bike lane JPEG thing is still up there, but that's not part of the graphic.
It's just hovering.
Hovering.
I'm trying to fix it.
So the overall framework, the overall framework of the design guidelines is really that we want policies and desired outcomes to really guide the decisions made in the transportation design. And so these are the outcomes that are in the design guidelines, you know, consistent with our 6 desired outcomes and with our regional transportation plan outcomes. And so the design recommendations in the guidelines, as well as the performance-based design process that's in the guidelines, all are geared to achieve these types of things. So we look through a lens of, is this going to increase safety for all modes? Is this going to increase in transportation choices, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera? And so this is sort of your litmus test. As you're picking out if you're figuring out the design of your transportation facility, is it helping achieve these design outcomes system-wide? Is it contributing to that transportation system?
I continue to ask goofy questions.
Of course.
The little abstract blue and black dots, do they represent something? Or are they just...
Next to security, you mean, or just...
Oh, is it security?
They're on healthy environment.
They're on healthy environment.
And security and healthy... Yeah, I see. And social equity.
I think they're very, it's very graphic and conceptual, but I mean, I think for social equity, it's like, it looks like it's sort of like many people or places, you know, things like that. Do you have a concern about them, or they strike you as odd? Okay.
I just noticed them and wondered if there was, you know, a message or something.
I have a question. In terms of our desired policy outcomes and how it's incorporated into the methodology for how we create the design principles, how are these things weighted against each other? Are they weighted equally? How does that look like from the more technical side?
Well, so in the, we have a whole chapter that's dedicated to providing a framework for decision making. And it doesn't provide specific weights for any of these things, because that's sort of something that you'll want to figure out for each project individually. Mm-hmm. But it does say you might want to weight some things differently than others. And I think one of the examples that we give is that if your project, for example, is in a area that has been historically underserved, and that perhaps there was some gentrification or some major displacement that occurred, if you're familiar, like with the Williams Bikeway project that occurred, if that's some part of the history of your project and you really want to find that out as part of the project, then you might want to weigh equity more than something else. So that's part of the decision-making process. What we do is, rather than providing specific weights, because it's really contextual, is say that you want to consider that.
Great. Go ahead, Mark.
I'd also add, in a performance-based design, I really like this visual. I don't want to jump ahead in this presentation, but decide the outcomes you want for that corridor, and I think President Peterson said it best, and then you, in my mind, you reconcile that with the space you have. So if you have a very clear outcome of transit, or you have a clear outcome of pedestrian safety, then you look at the space you have and you allocate it accordingly to achieve those outcomes. Is that...
Yeah, that's great.
I'm sorry. So if you're in Columbia Corridor, you're going to have to weigh the different outcomes that corridor needs to serve, right? From kids who I've seen biking with their parents to the massive amount of freight. And how do you design that? Because they both need to be in that space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because there's no other options.
Mm-hmm. And in that case... It's a tricky corridor, so thanks for the example.
In that case, I advocate for and get a bridge to go over Columbia into the St. John's.
Something that's where separation of the nodes, which are currently not separated, but when you... speed is also a factor, and I think we all know, but I'll just say it for the record, that if a car hits a pedestrian or bike at 40 miles an hour, that pedestrian only has 10% chance of living. They're hit at 20 miles an hour, they have a 90% chance of living. So this is where the safety overlay comes in. And if you have a situation where you do have freight that needs to move fast, then you start looking at the allocation of space and then the separation of that space, as Lake alluded to. And it's really important. Now, if you can slow everybody down to 20 miles per hour or less, then there's more opportunity to mix the modes in a safe way. So, but Columbia is tough, and we don't currently have separation right there.
No.
So maybe a bridge is the option.
I was just putting in a plug for the work that
we've already done.
Yeah.
my follow-up question would be for planning departments that might not have not necessarily the expertise of recognizing what an underserved community or a historic project having negative impacts, but not necessarily knowing where to start on how to measure those things. I'm sure we offer technical assistance, and this is almost setting me up for the T2020 question of how we're going to help our partners scale up to deliver these design decisions and policy outcomes based on what we see should be, those outcomes should be, but also recognizing that they're going to have their own local implementation plans. I'd like to see where that connection is, because I can only imagine the community development department and the roads team at the city of Cornelius has a lot less capacity to think about these issues on that scale than the city of Portland might. So how does that connect with some of the smaller jurisdictions that might not even have the wherewithal to consider how their roads and racial equity intersect?
Yeah, we do have a lot of data that we're always happy to share, and part of the overall Livable Streets program does include technical assistance, and then the performance-based planning framework, which I'll get into in just a minute, provides some high-level guidance and almost sort of questions about where, you know, this is the type of data you need, and then our project website, which once this is finalized, will have, you know, ways to access that or who to call to get some of that information. Okay, so...
The things that we have put out there, though, is that that every project on these corridors will conform to these design standards.
Well, not to get too deep in the weeds, but I would suggest that when a project is brought forward, it's because it's lacking in one or more of these issues, of these areas. And so you identify which of these areas is lacking, and then how do you address it?
Good point.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. To wrap that up in case it comes again, Nathan and I did meet this morning, and we will be bringing this to council as a resolution to kind of solidify its legal status, and then we'll be requesting through the IGAs that we sign with our delivery partners that they follow these guidelines. So that will be it'll be a contractual mechanism to which to hold our partners to.
Mm-hmm. Following an engagement process you're going to describe, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You're going to describe it. Yeah. Timeline back here.
The engagement process on... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not sure if we're talking about the guidelines now or T2020, so I think they're related. But I hear you wanting an engagement process on T2020 that I think to elaborate on Lake's answer to your question, Councillor Gonzalez, my experience in delivering projects when I had a capital budget underneath me for PBOT was there's the initial analysis of saying, does this community need investment? That's one way to do your equity lens on this. But when it gets into design, it's about listening to the community. And one of the missteps City of Portland made, and they're open about this, so I can speak to it on Williams, is that the people of color in that community had been asking for a long time for curb cuts and ADA ramps. And the bike lane went in first. And so that was investing in an area of communities of color, but not listening to the community. And so I think we use that and we learn from that example and say, how do we go better and listen to what the needs are and then make sure the design reflects the needs of those community members. So it is all related.
Mm-hmm. Councilor Craddock had a question.
Well, Mike, this one maybe can wait, but I'm sitting here listening and trying to... And make sure I understand. So, how will have this resolution and we've agreed upon this, then it becomes part. It will become part of the RTP, and then every project that is built in the future using regional flexible funds will have to follow these guidelines. Is that basically how this is going to work? If a jurisdiction doesn't use RFFA funds, do they have to follow the guidelines?
Great question. We're exploring with their attorneys. Unfortunately, Michelle just walked out just in time because I was trying to make eye contact with her. But Nathan and Michelle and I are working on exactly what we can see in the resolution. What we do know is we have authority to require it if we give someone funding. That's clear. And we can say that in a resolution, and we can say that in an IGA. Beyond that, it's less clear where our guidelines could apply, and we're going to look at some authority we may or may not have in the MTIP that's less clear. Does that make sense? So it's when our money is the hook.
And so any ODOT roads that are built in the region, will that come under this too?
Correct.
Okay.
Which way did you shake your head?
Yes.
That's an interesting question.
Yeah, I think President Peterson, is putting together a way to best communicate with ODOT and OTC on that. Is that correct?
Yes. We will be working on that.
I probably, we're kind of jumping around, but I just... Well, thank you.
I could speak to that point. It seems to me the clearest example in my mind is that just as we're engaging with community partners, including local governments that manage and build transportation elements, we are having an engagement process around these design standards, because if there's a T2020 investment program and we do want to condition how those projects are delivered, we will have shared these guidelines with our partners and gotten their input and feedback and helped them become more familiar with them if they're not already, so that we're all more or less on the same page about how we're going to do it, as well as how much we're going to do and what corridors we're going to invest in when we go to the ballot. That's how I see this evolving. We're we're anticipating the kinds of conversations we need to have as we move forward toward this regional decision, including how we build the things we invest in.
So while we're jumping around, that was a great plug for the April 21st event in which 22nd event, where all the electeds, a lot of the electeds in the region are going to be invited in the morning, and then all of their technical staff, relevant technical staff, and that's head of the planning departments, head of the engineering departments, are going to do a workshop with Lake and our consultants in the afternoon. So we're doing just that, Councillor Stacey.
Can I make a request for that day?
Mm-hmm.
So it's Earth Day. Can we have chocolate pudding with Oreo crumbles and gummy worms on top? Just like,
dirt.
Elementary school on Earth Day? No? Nobody had that memory?
I remember that one.
We're going to have that memory. It sounds like that.
Earth Day was my senior year in high school.
Oh, my goodness. Every day is Earth Day.
Well, we are including lunch, so.
I was a sophomore.
I'm saying.
This is a really good partnership with
Earth. You are certainly welcome to bring that for
everybody. Share. Our cooking skills is quite
excellent.
A little muffin table, girls.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. Individual.
And so, Councillor Craddock, just to make sure you're clear, so currently the design guidelines, when we do for regional flexible funds funded projects, those projects need to be consistent with our design guidelines. That's already in the MTIP right now, adopted policy.
And those are the guidelines that you have in that book right there that were from 2000, what?
Two. Yeah.
I'm thinking of the mile that ODOT's building on Powell Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if they're following the design guidelines.
Not currently.
Is that a rough project?
No.
Oh, yeah. If it's there's a lot less, you know, ability. I mean, our functional plan says the jurisdiction or agencies have to allow for these guides, but there's nothing to make them use them if we're not funding the project.
Sorry, we're all over the place. So you're trying to.
I love it. It's awesome.
You're learning
totally,
together.
Yeah. So in addition to the outcomes that I just showed you, those 12 outcomes, we also have we'll really use the framework of functions. So what are the different functions of a highway, of a street, of a regional trail? And so this is a sort of an imaginary street, and you can sort of get a sense of some of the design elements we're including, like enhanced transit corridors and separated bikeways and wide sidewalks that are ADA accessible, et cetera. Lots and lots of stormwater and green infrastructure. So we've identified with our technical work group a set of functions for the streets, and these are really used to help then work through the different trade-offs when you have a constrained corridor, you're going to be retrofitting a street, or you're putting in a new street. What do you need to What types of functions does that street need to serve? And then you start to use our design classifications and some other parameters that are in our decision-making framework to try to work through those trade-offs. And, you know, one of the design approaches that we're proposing, for example, is if you have a lot of different competing functions, historically, a lot of times what happens is you just sort of eliminate the sidewalk or make a really narrow sidewalk, maybe a really narrow bike lane, and then you can keep your adhere to your, you know, travel lane standards. We're saying take a more balanced approach, look at like narrowing everything potentially so you can fit everything in and still achieve what you need to on that roadway. We're also looking at more of a corridor approach so that with really, really well documented decisions, maybe you put your bikeway on a low traffic
Parallel street,
but it really needs to be part of the project, part of the overall thinking. You can't just not include it and not worry about it. So it's really taking a more thoughtful, you know, this very thoughtful approach to how can we achieve an overall well-functioning transportation system. So not every street needs to necessarily serve every function equally, but you do need to serve those functions on the system somehow. That makes sense. So this is a very simplistic graphic, preceding the next graphic I'll show you, that just really tries to emphasize that In a performance-based process, you're really, your design elements are, it's a toolbox of things. So a design element is like your travel lane width or street trees or sidewalk, bikeway, transit enhancements. Those are all your tools. And you use those, you kind of pick and choose the right ones to serve the functions that you've identified as being really important on that particular corridor to achieve the outcomes. And you continually kind of check back. And so really trying to make sure that you know what functions you need to serve on that project and, is important. So this is what we'll be bringing to our work group next week. It's our performance-based design framework. It's also on your handout, a little bit easier to read. Kind of a little road. I think ODOT has a
racetrack.
We have kind of a meandering path. No, a meandering street. Did you say a tapeworm? I do not like that.
No, it's not a tapeworm.
But I'm going to think about that now. I'm going to have to... Yeah,
be your rubber. I apologize.
They have little cars.
So it's a series of steps that you want to work through in your decision as you're developing your project, developing the design of the project. Each one of these steps gets 2 to 4 pages in the chapter that really describe what that step is and provides some detailed questions that you need to be asking, provides examples and resources. And this is a process that it looks at context, it is practical design, it is includes value engineering, it includes all these different approaches that have been out there that are really like helpful in thinking differently about how to design a project, not using sort of a cookbook standards-based approach, like, okay, we've got a project, here's our table, says to do this, all right, that's what we're doing. Done. That was easy. It takes a more nuanced approach, and it's you need to really gather a lot of information. You need to think about what you're trying to achieve and continually check back. A very important part of this design process is stakeholder engagement throughout the process, and really, especially the impacted community nearby, but having a lot of check-ins with people to be able to get their input in the process. And then documenting your decisions throughout the process. And so there's details on that in the chapter about what you need to be documenting to really show why you're making certain decisions. And if you do that, it's a very robust process, and you should, even if, you know, not everyone's happy at the end, you can really show why you made the decisions that you did. It also shows that you really considered things and you continue to check back to your outcomes and the purpose and need of the project and what you're trying to achieve. This process is very much about looking at what your adopted policies are. So reducing greenhouse gas emissions, achieving Vision Zero, multimodal travel, reliable freight times. So you're looking at what your adopted policies are, and you want to make sure that you are designing your projects to implement those policies. So that's a big part of the process. And then using data, it's very data-driven, so making sure that you're collecting the appropriate data, potentially weighting the different performance measures that you're going to use. We have the Regional Transportation Plan, which has a strong set of performance measures, so we reflect back to those. That's your starting place, and then you're going to have very specific project-based performance measures. And it also has a place where it's like, well, if you're not achieving what you said you were going to do, why, you know, maybe you need to go back to the drawing board and kind of bring in some additional considerations. So this is something that we heard from agency partners that they really would like, because especially in situations where trade-offs are so challenging, when you have streets that are a regional freight corridor, a frequent bus route, a regional bikeway, a boulevard in our, you know, 2040 land use, like, how do you achieve all of that on this street? And so this is not going to, like, figure it out, but it's hopefully providing some good check-ins and questions that can be asked throughout the process. And it's based on current national best practices, and we're relying especially on a technical report that is looking at land use and context-sensitive performance-based design decision-making.
And I'm curious to hear what feedback our county agency development transportation planning partners expressed throughout the process. Specifically, north of 26 in Washington County, you have a huge urban area. I mean, if it was a city, it'd be the second biggest city in Oregon. And as I learn more about transportation, obviously the setup of our local government, what are the challenges that the Washington County Transportation Department has in one, working as a county transportation agency, while also having to work as a local transportation planning agency to meet the urban needs of a growing urban area? I mean, do we feel like they're well-equipped with their expertise and their staffing to really implement these policy designs on the local level? Maybe.
I figured you'd have some thoughts.
I think there's a couple things there, and I want to be careful that everybody is in different stages of learning new design and understanding new design. So, you know, City of Portland obviously is always kind of the first out of the gate in a lot of these things, but they have a constituency that really wants this. My understanding is that Washington County is updating their design guidelines right now. So that's kind of exciting, and I think Councilor Gonzalez or Councilor Dirksen, if you want to get involved in that process, I would definitely reach out to Andrew Singalakis and ask how, or I can do that on your behalf. Mm-hmm. So it's a good time to have that conversation. I do think that some of the county engineers have been focused more on the ASHTO, the highway approach. So this is something that we want to work with them on. We have been attending, Lake has a robust stakeholder process of 40 people, right, in a group. 40 people have been attending and weighing in. So this is not going to be new to any of our partners. They've been at the table, but you know, everybody's on a spectrum of their comfort level with innovation and performance-based design. Mm-hmm. So does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. What are in those engagement stakeholder meetings, what are the engineers, what is the sense? What are they saying? Do they feel like they're going to be able to meet the T2020 goals? And if we're going too deep into something that we shouldn't necessarily say now, that's okay.
Well, the work group has not talked about T2020 at all. Yeah, I mean, the Washington County engineer has actually been fairly quiet in the meetings. I think one of the things that we kind of run into a little bit is different ideas about what the street should look like or do. And that's a tension always that's going to be out there, and like different ideas about, you know, what the function is of the street. So for Tualatin Valley Highway, for example, which is a street that comes up a lot, and that street is, you know, really serves as a major mobility corridor for auto travel, but also for transit. And so because of that, it also has a lot of people walking because they're getting on and off the bus. And so there's an inherent sort of tension in that, and I'll just be fairly candid and just say one of the, you know, kind of dialogues that came up was one of our design approaches, for example, for transit, especially frequent bus, is that you don't have the bus pulling out into the, you know, pulling off to load passengers and then have to pull back. That for a frequent bus route, you really want in-lane loading, so that you want the bus to just stop, people to get on the bus, and the bus continues. It's going to really increase the timing of that bus. Someone said, you know, I can't really see that happening on TV highway because the speeds are high and we just can't have buses stopping like that. Well, you know, these guides are looking ahead to, like, what do we want our streets to function like. I think, personally, that we can, that it's totally achievable on a street like that if you make, you know, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some difference of opinions about how you, what the function of the street is, what you're prioritizing. I definitely think Washington County has the expertise. There's really great people working out there. And so this is really just ideas about how you would make work through some of those trade-offs and what and how you would balance some of that. So they've also got some really, they're starting to get some really good tools out there. And I hope for their design guidance that it's somewhat consistent with ours and along the same lines.
I need to move quickly.
Okay. So you included in your packet was the outline of the design guidelines. If you want to delve in that deep, you're welcome to, but it just really shows what we're going to be including in the design guidance if you want a better sense of what's there. And then just to give you a sense of an example, and I'll move through this very quickly, of what a design element would be. This is for motor vehicle travel lanes. This is one of our design elements, and we are providing pretty updated guidance along this for this approach. And it's the idea that you really want to consider a lot of different factors when you're figuring out how to divide up your right-of-way, which is pretty limited, very expensive. We're not getting more of it. So you want to have to consider all these different functions and needs. And our regional transportation plan, regional transportation plan includes guidance on the number of lanes. This is in our current policy and will be carried forward in the guidelines. So for each of our design classifications, it talks about the number of lanes that that type of facility should have. And then we'll be providing a table similar to this, it'll look better, but that talks about what the preferred width is. And our design approach is to really start with a narrower width. City of Portland's already adopted that policy, and it is different than, say, what ODOT has. They have a 12-foot standard for their lanes as the desired width. We're recommending, you know, you start with a narrower width so that you can include more functions, wider sidewalks, more bike lanes, better transit facilities, et cetera. It still has that flexibility there should it make sense to go up to a wider lane. But this is the design approach we're taking, and it's based on a lot of research showing, looking at mobility and safety for all modes, and shows that this approach works for that. Next steps, giving a quick update to JPACT on March 21st. We've got the April 22nd Policymakers Forum, and then we'll be coming back to you with giving you a preview of the final draft guidelines. So I think we've started to hit on a lot of these questions in the conversations, but these were the sort of the policy questions that we had in your work session worksheet.
And I've got about 5 more minutes on this topic, so yeah.
I have a question. Thank you. I think this is going to be a really nice element to have kind of moving forward and as we're working on these big transportation visions, helped kind of bring it down to earth. One of the things that kind of sticks out to me is, you know, we have so much history and knowledge in terms of informing this work, and I'm sure that's gone, you know, heavily into it. I can see that. We also have this changing environment that's so rapidly changing, as you know. I would not be surprised if, you know, in a fairly short period of time in our lives, you know, bike lanes are used by folks who want to get some exercise on their bikes, or old timers that still like to use their bikes, you know. And a very heavy dose of electric vehicles, bikes that you can, if you want, to pedal, but are really powered, you know, on electricity, and scooters. I think we're going to see a lot of momentum around the scooters. And so that's one element. And then, of course, there's the whole automated vehicle and, you know, Uber and Lyft. And so it's these, and how do people get in and out of those? And, you know, add on to that whether we actually do get some significant progress around congestion pricing. And all of a sudden you have a you know, incredibly different transportation environment. And so how do we in kind of real time project those changes? And because, you know, do we expect folks to just, hey, it's the bike lanes that are going to be used for the more electronic, you know, electric but motorized vehicles? Or are we expecting them sidewalks? Or are we expecting them to use the roads? You know, how are we setting ourselves up for handling what I think is a pretty predictable outcome? You know, it's a matter of when. And then how do we, you know, do that also on the kind of AV, you know, Uber, Lyft kind of side of things? So where does that fit in?
Well, we do acknowledge that, and we do, like, one of the design elements is the flex zone, and that's going to look at drop-off and pick-up for things like TNCs, something like a bikeway. We talk about how you design for, in some ways, the unknown, but a variety of users, a variety of different travel speeds. So we acknowledge it. And we can look forward to doing potentially like case studies as we move forward and having those as standalone case studies on our project webpage. So it is in flux, in motion. It's happening, but we don't exactly know how it's all going to play out. We just know that we need strong policy guidance for it.
Yeah, and I would just add, I think those are super interesting, good questions, and a lot of innovation is happening right now in what this area of flex space and light lanes, calling them light lanes as in carbon light lanes, and I think you'll see more of that, and the urban design guides call out the need for flexibility, and I think going forward, as we have a changing transportation environment, designers will have to get flexible, and frankly, that the ASHTO guidelines will become more and more outdated if they don't allow this flexibility in a changing environment. But to your Uber and Lyft comment, you know, curb space management is really important. I think a lot of cities are starting to focus on that. NACTO, as an organization, National Organization of Cities, has taken on curbside management as kind of one of their number one issues. And when I see they're taking it on, it's kind of maybe being more intentional about where they want the pickup and drop-off zones to be, and where it makes sense for them to be. Under Elliott Rose, we're doing a shared mobility study where we're going to study where all the options are in the region, and hopefully that will help inform our partners of where these kind of curbside needs are. Mm-hmm. So, sorry, we've gone long, but...
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning it's in the document. I obviously did not do enough thorough reading in there, but I was looking for it, and I didn't see it, and I guess my thought is there a way we can, just for thought, is a way we can really kind of elevate the options, that design guideline options that folks have in ways that are as visible as some of these others, you know, even in these kinds of ways? Because I think projects that are getting conceived today, you know, may not get built for 5 or 10 years, right? And I think we're going to see... interest in making changes even more and more as we go. And so it's not, you know, forcing something that we kind of an unpredictable future, but it's some awareness that I think a lot of electeds and leaders around the region see it kind of happening. And so if we're giving them choices and helping them, you know, hey, these set of, we're fairly confident this set of kind of design strategies is going to be very productive in the future. We're sort of confident these might be, you know, and these are kind of, we don't know enough yet to know. But I don't know if there's some way of presenting some of that fits.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, let me just wrap this up.
I got a question still.
You still have a question? Go ahead.
It's more of a comment than
okay.
The word speeds, travel speeds, is used on slide 13. But it doesn't permeate the document in the way that I would wish it did. Obviously,
and design speed.
Sorry?
And design speed.
Well, that's the relationship I'm getting toward, but that's a technical term that I don't completely understand. I know the speeds on Powell Boulevard, where 12 or wider foot lanes predominate in inner southeast, and the speeds on Division 10 blocks away, which is a much smaller street with only two lanes instead of five,
are remarkably different, unless it's 4 a.m. and somebody's drunk. It's extraordinarily dangerous to cross Powell in a rapid flash beacon crosswalk because that design induces 45-mile-an-hour travel on a street that's posted for 35.
Because it was designed to be a highway.
Well, it's designed by ODOT, and if they insist that the lanes have to be 12 feet wide, yeah, it will stay that way, and it'll be one less lost opportunity for repurposing a very substantial right-of-way to serve more users, including the kinds that Councillor Chase was talking about. So I'd like to see, if at all possible, more emphasis on the relationship between speed and design, and particularly travel or lane widths in this document.
Just major
to
issue.
Hammer home that point, that if we want safe outcomes, we've got to stripe our streets differently and add more space for other uses than fast-moving cars. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Absolutely. Right. Councilor Gonzalez?
I have a question. With the last question on the slide that says, in regards to regional street and trail design, I don't know if I necessarily saw a lot about trails in the presentation and the materials that we digested. But is it almost a mirror reflection of the types of the same applications?
Yeah, the whole framework is the same. And then there's very specific guidance for building trails and designing them. But just in trying to be brief,
yes,
I was trying to really pick and choose like kind of what I was highlighting.
I have some technical questions about some of the cross sections. We don't need to talk about it here, but if I could do an offline with you, I'd
absolutely
appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
Any other comments or questions? I was just going to come back around and say at the very end of the day, a lot of councillors' questions, including Councillor Chase, about the future, if at the basis of every decision that we're promoting is that we're trying to move more people and more freight as cost-effectively and safely as possible, if that's how we're moving this policy discussion, that's a huge leap forward to whatever technology comes out, because then you're talking about slower speeds, medium speeds, and high speeds, and what should be put where based on what the vehicle itself does. It doesn't matter if it's human-driven or if there's a different type of fuel in the tank. But sorry, because they don't have tanks. But the point is, the technology does not drive the outcome. It should, right? The technology should not be the driver. It should be about what outcomes we want for people and movement of our economy on the ground, not about how we're allowing the app to control our lives.
Yeah.
So, I think that's what we're trying to get at in here, is to force that conversation every single time that there is no default.
Yeah. And my only concern, and with my very novice understanding of technical transportation policy, is going back to the questions that I had around Washington County, and obviously there are different schools of thought that approach how we design and obviously create transportation infrastructure. And my concern is that there might be some of our implementing partners that look at the broad array of criteria that we identified in CO2, safety, economic sustainability, et cetera, and pick and choose, obviously, and not necessarily create the type of design standards and the livability that we would want to see. And my mind keeps going back to the North Bethany neighborhood that has just single lane roads with no sidewalks, no bike lanes, no access to transit, and the county is their planning agency. And if the county doesn't prioritize that, then thousands of people in that community lose out on that.
So I think we hear you, and I know we're trying to wrap this up. We can talk about it more offline, but what you should know is the same consultant team, who are very talented engineers at Kittleson, are the same consultant team that is helping us with the T2020 measure. So when we have a meeting with the same team that's going out to Washington County, our team is ready to walk them through specifically all the design exceptions in order to help them get to a place. So we are looking at this in terms of the T2020 projects as a partnership and using our consultants to help them get there. So I feel maybe overly confident at this point of the conversation that we can make it happen. Okay.
Yep. All right. Thank you. Good work.
Thank you very much.
Look forward to having you back.
Thanks.
And adoption. All right. Andy Shaw, you're up for a regional investment strategy update. Thank you.
Right on time.
All righty. Good afternoon. So, three sections to this update, and then we're going to run our little animation program.
Yep. I saw that. I'm very pleased.
So, first on parks and nature, lots of engagement going on right now, as promised. The Parks and Nature Stakeholder Table met today. I think a couple of you were there. Martha and Councillor Gonzalez, I think, were both there. So you might... Okay, you might have more on that than I do. It sounds like there was very robust engagement around the direction Council gave and positive feedback, the beginning of sort of getting more detail in some of those buckets. But overall, a very good interaction this morning. Martha and I and John Blaster and Brian Kennedy met with the regional city-county managers yesterday. For that group, I think, had a very engaging and productive discussion. They're a very practical bunch, so they don't always engage in the same way that, say, our parks directors do. Mostly a discussion around the parks and nature renewal and local option, how that might work, thinking about the array of trails. We had a similar discussion this morning, what are access to nature trails versus what are commuter trails, and where does a funding conversation properly reside on those. John Blaster and staff are meeting with the regional parks directors this afternoon, right now, and the focus is again on mostly on local investments and the structure of that. You all, I believe, either were emailed or discussed a memo from John on some scaling of the various groups of investment areas. I think for many of you up at the zoo, for some thereafter. But we're going over some of that with these groups so they have some sense of what range of dollar amounts we're thinking of in these various areas to get towards that detail. And that you may be hearing some back around people's reactions to how well funded those various areas are, how people think they should be enlarged. I don't think anyone's wanting to shrink any particular area from what we're hearing yet. There was a trails forum last week. I think it was right over here in 370. Some of the counselors were there. It was pretty good attendance. Looked like it was very engaging. I didn't actually go in, but I could see from outside that lots of interesting discussion. Blue Lake Open House happened yesterday. I didn't hear an update. It is tonight. Okay. My notes are wrong. Okay. And we've got still upcoming engagements around Glen Devere, Canoe Bluff, and Newell Creek Canyon, as we talked about last time we updated. So we're doing sort of these open house engagements around master plans and project concepts in those areas, getting feedback that will help feed into the Parks and Nature measure. Staff will be at work session next week to discuss the ranges memo that you all talked about and the feedback that we're getting so far. That's primarily sort of a here's what we're hearing moment and launching into April, and then in April staff will bring back more of a proposal to get approval from council to bring that proposal out and get feedback on the actual concept of what we would proposing to take to the ballot so that by May or early June you're prepared to refer something. I think that's all I have for now on parks, unless there are questions.
I don't have a question. I just want to say I think our Metro Council President and John Blaster did a really good job last night. The Portland Parks Foundation hosted an event, and I was very impressed with the number of people that attended.
Like 400?
Yeah. And so thank you. It was well done. So.
Thanks. Well prepped.
There clearly were three stars that a lot of people wanted to hear from, including the president, John, and the new superintendent of parks for the city of Portland. Yeah. And you did a great job. Thank you.
Thank you. That's fun.
Yeah.
All right. On to housing. So also, lots of activity, maybe not as active in terms of engagement as Parks and Nature. The Oversight Committee had its second meeting just this last Monday, Craig? Just yesterday? A week ago Monday. And they agreed on the decision-making protocol, which they'd been working on since their first meeting. I know our staff are really, really excited about the group of people and the talent and knowledge in that room, so very appreciative of your appointment of them. You are expected to consider a resolution on the first Phase 1 project next week. The resolution for that is in Granicus. This is moving forward on a new build concept in Beaverton. So you, as you recall, there's the set of first phase projects that each of the cities and the county housing authorities have been working on. This is the first one to actually get enough legs to be ready for. So a nod that that if you're comfortable with it, it can advance.
Following review by the committees that.
So these phase one projects are moving ahead on their own track, not necessarily going through the process that projects will go through after implementation plans are adopted and through the normal oversight process. But we wanted to get some, the concept was to get some early projects out there, show some movement while we work through the implementation plans overall and advance the lion's share of the resources to local governments.
At least one of the partner local entities, either a housing authority or, in this case, the city of Beaverton, is forwarding the project.
Oh, they're all coming from the three housing authorities or one of the four cities. Yes, yes.
So just to clarify, so these are projects that they already had in their pipeline that our funds are able to support. Is that how you
say
that?
For the most part, they vary in each place. Clackamas, for example, owns a lot of housing, so their proposal may well be around some of the units and areas they already own. The City of Portland's been working on a project north of here for some time, so that's more like in the pipeline. I think this Beaverton is more of an opportunistic thing. It's exciting. You'll hear more about it, though, yes.
Andy, the Phase 1 projects, are they receiving, are they a proportional investment as they would in Phase 2 or the normal phase throughout the life of the bond?
I don't have a good answer to that question. We could follow up in terms of scale. I think they're all their initial projects as opposed to the bulk of what a jurisdiction has, but there are other staff who would know that answer better than I that we can have follow up.
If I may. They must, of course, count toward the
absolutely
total number of units, the total number of bedrooms, and the range of affordability
yep.
that each of the participant jurisdictions are.
And all the jurisdictions understand, there's this clear goal of the expectation of how many units. So they're working on projects that advance those goals and fit within the overall targets that the council set and the voters approved. The housing team is hiring a policy manager, an analyst, and the communications engagement staff. They're each sort of in different stages of the hiring process. We'll keep you posted on results and details there. But even while this work's going on, they're still working to staff up. And they're, even with the limited staff, continuing to meet weekly with our implementation partners, working through all the gnarly issues of how you advance a project through the process and get proper oversight and yet have the nimble ability to move, especially these sort of opportunistic projects, forward. And they are scheduled, housing staff are scheduled to come talk to you April 16th to talk about the implementation strategy development that's going on locally. And also present some options for the site acquisition portion of the bond measure.
So I'm just curious, as you're moving forward with working with the partners, I guess what is the general attitude or interest or is there concern? Is there resistance? Is there thrill?
All of the above.
I guess I'm kind of...
Yeah, no, it's a great question. All of the above. I don't think... I think the partnership has deepened since just before referral, but I think the sense of you set audacious goals, the voters approved audacious goals for the output of these, it remains. And but our local governments, our partners are committed to working through ways to achieve those goals. They haven't yet really begun doing the hard work of their local implementation plans, so... I think there's some trepidation about, you know, how hard or easy will that process be. And then just the ongoing sort of practice of when they bring a project forward, what is the process for moving it through the pipeline of our oversight process and back to them and development and then Metro Council approval. So I think there's still some trepidation about how hard or easy will that process be. What does that oversight look and feel like to them as they're trying to advance projects that meet local objectives? So all those concerns still remain because we haven't really worked the process yet.
If I could just follow up, because the stakeholders that we worked with during the, you know, the preparation for the major and then during the campaign itself, is somewhat changed because how we distribute the money is different than the group of people that we were working with initially, or at least a little bit. You know, when we chose that we knew all along that we would be distributing the money to the three housing authorities, mm-hmm. but then to the CDBG cities, mm-hmm. and they. I would say they were not all as involved in that stakeholder group.
I can think of one in particular.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, that's what my curiosity is how is that, you know, now that it's shifted, where there's who now has to really put all this in place?
I think amongst our local partners, everyone's in the nose to the grindstone. How do we get this done? And some of them are staffing up. Beaverton had hired people last year, actually, to beef up their housing staff in preparation for this and other goals they have. We've seen some local jurisdictions enact their own policies and enact some additional investments. And fee waiver programs. So there's a lot of activity going on, a lot of excitement. I think making this partnership work is the next challenge, and everyone seems committed to it. Great. That's all I had on housing. So on transportation, again, a lot of engagement going on in this area, a lot of energy. We've had task force meetings, I think, since we last did an update like this. A lot of exciting energy there. The co-chairs are fantastic, have really sort of grabbed the leadership reins. Key takeaways, there's the values that they put up on a value board over in this part of the room that we turned into a Wordle. I don't know if we've shared that Wordle yet. We showed it this morning at the Washington County Commission presentation. We put the Wordles into a value. The values into a Wordle. You know, where they the bigger, the more frequent words show up in big print, and one of those. But what we're seeing is that the things that they brought up, that they brought to the table, their values in terms of transportation investment align very, very well with the values that you laid out. If we just start to nest them within the areas that you prioritized for investment, you can find a good home for everything in what you've laid out. So there seems to be good alignment. We haven't actually had that conversation yet about the alignment, but we're at the staff level, we're seeing it. The next meeting, which is next week, we dive into the into corridors, which you directed us to have as the starting place. We've got the 60 corridors that have existing problematic conditions and then growth areas. We've been out talking with a variety of people about now's the moment to bring forth, is this the full picture of corridors, of areas that we want to focus on, including places that don't have a corridor marked in the map but might have a growth area or something else that we're not thinking of, and now's the time to bring those to the table. That discussion will be on the 20th at the task force. We then plan to work through essentially tiering the corridors and areas that are brought up, so we have a better understanding of where are corridors more ready for investment, what kind of outcomes do you get from the point of view that you directed us around safety, around congestion, around GHG reduction, all those kinds of, how can we do a high-level sorting to start to get some sense of where do these corridors fall out on a sort of tiered list. So that will be what we'll be working on through April and into May, working to get the task force to a place where they can recommend to you a more of a focused list. Not that we're taking things off of the list, but more of a place to focus on for the next round. The next round, to remind you, is to get our local partners working with community to start advancing more specific projects and investments along those key corridors. So the tiering process is to indicate to them the places that are more likely to be in the final mix and places they should be focusing their energy, as opposed to if something's tiered far down the list, they could choose to do work on advancing projects in those areas, but they may or may not make it in the final round. So that's where we are with the task force.
And we've got new folks that we're going to need to put on as other folks have decided to step off because
Again?
Of time commitments.
More people?
Replacement. Not more members.
I remember last week we spoke about people stepped off and we had to replace, and it happened again, just another wave of replacement.
About five people for a variety of reasons who realized either, Diane McKeel, her board meets the nights we've picked to meet, so it just isn't going to work for her to...
Yeah.
Mayor Bemis determined for his own reasons he couldn't do it. We've got a counselor there. Andrea Durbin got a new job. She doesn't work for the environmental. Or she won't be working for the environmental council anymore. So it's that flavor of changes that or reasons that we need to make some changes. So we'll be bringing. We're checking in with people who are potential replacements, and we'll be bringing a resolution to you probably in April to formally ask for confirmation of changing some of those names. But upon appointment, they can attend the task force. In fact, a couple folks attended the last task force meeting.
I'd like to ask a question just prior to this discussion. So when you said the next step is the local jurisdictions will be going out and working with their public to fine-tune the corridor and the projects that are in that corridor. Is that correct?
Correct.
So are we working with them on how they reach out to the public, or is that going to be up to their discretion?
Yes. So the contract that Margie mentioned earlier with Kittleson spreads to some of that local work around the corridors and specific projects. The contract, the master contract we have with our facilitator also extends to that process. So there's facilitation services, and then we are already working with our local jurisdictional partner staff on how that process can work, what other help that we can bring.
I would think if you're working with the people, the community that live along the corridor, you might want to make sure you invite them to these discussions. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that is always would be done. They would have to be specifically invited.
It's a challenging time frame or time constraint in which to do all this work in an engaged as possible process, where we are working with some key organizations to figure out how do we engage a broad array of community voices in that process, as opposed to broader engagement around the overall measure in the tight time frame that we have. So we're going to try to do the best we can, but it's not going to be a Southwest Corridor style process where we've got years of study around options and then limit bringing it down to a locally preferred alternative, et cetera, et cetera.
Still years of planning to do in some of these corridors.
There may be ways for us to do some of it, so thanks.
All right, so we already did that one. So now we're going to do this little, it's only animated when I click it, but we'll just walk through, and if I get a little sing-songy, I apologize in advance. But
Indy, can I go back real quick? Sorry.
Yeah.
So bringing up the question this morning that Commissioner Rogers made about corridors, which I interpreted to be one thing, is in Metro should figure out what a corridor is, because a corridor to me is, the interstate, essentially is what I understood. And a corridor to you is this street here. So they're different, right? And they have different needs, et cetera. Essentially, and from that, the question that Chair Harrington made is, can you let us know when the commission needs to, have X information to make this decision or to support Commissioner Treese, et cetera? Do we have a specific engagement plan for our implementing jurisdictions and how we engage city councilors, mayors, county commissioners, and the commission chair? Or is that a responsibility we're delegating to the task force?
It is partly task force members. We've also been meeting with their staffs for the last 2 years on a monthly basis at least to coordinate work and our discussions. That doesn't always percolate up to the full council commission. So we're trying to balance between getting out and doing these presentations like you and I did this morning at Washington County Commission and relying on some of the members to come back and bring information forward. We're also, staff and Councilor Dirksen are going to talk to the Washington County Coordinating Committee, which is probably more in the structures we have where some of those conversations go about bringing priorities forward and talking about what kinds of projects in the corridors that get advanced are the most fundamental. Would also just share that Commissioner Rogers in this morning's discussion said what he called himself his old saw, which is a plea to have the region focus on more regional facilities and not on local streets, local sidewalks. A plea for others to bring their own resource to the table, not just rely on the region or the state to fund activities. So this is not new at all, and it's reflective of discussions about how we use flexible funds and a long history of discussion about are we funding very local things that should be met with local dollars, or are we really focusing on the regional system?
Hmm. Thank you, Andy.
You bet. Just on that note, Councilor Gonzalez and I presented this morning at Washington County. We had the chance, Councilperson Peterson and a few staff, to go present to C4, the Clackamas County Coordinating Committee, last week, and we'll be before the Clackamas County Business Alliance tomorrow morning at 7:30, bright and early. So lots of engagements, presentations, discussion, generally very positive, but trying to get folks motivated to bring their ideas forward and into the task force process.
At least the Washington County Coordinating Committee meetings are at a more civilized hour.
Midday, is it?
Midday.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. So we've developed this in an effort to introduce corridors, to introduce the concept of corridors, what they are, what we're talking about, the breadth of kinds of places. So this is an effort. We all have places we start from and places we're trying to go with a journey in between. We're not alone on our trips, as other people in our region have places to go to. Our journeys can overlap, as some routes present the quickest and most direct way to get to our destinations. The routes where our trips converge are corridors. Corridors are not just roadways that serve cars from point A to point B. Corridors support different kinds of travel along a common course where all people can travel safely and reliably. Our trips converge in corridors across the region. Corridors are a part of communities. People move through corridors. They move within corridors. And people start in and move out of corridors. As growth continues and more people move here, corridors are getting busier. This has impacts. Delays, safety challenges, impacts on community livability, impacts on our economy. And these impacts are felt beyond any one corridor, as an issue in one corridor can impact other corridors, and so on, and so on, affecting the region's whole network. Corridors connect us all. Oops, and now, meet some corridors. So this also visually shows...
I swipe left or right.
That's good. I like it or I don't like it.
And whether I want to date that corridor, that's my kind of dating app. Right.
So, we've got a limited access highway, you've got a busy downtown kind of throughway, you've got a TV highway down the lower left. I think is that division on top? On top of right, and then a bike path next to the orange line down in near Milwaukee. So a wide variety of kinds of places. We're using this to try to get across or try to sort of get ahead of the question of, wait, what do you mean when you say a corridor? And so far, it seems to be effective. It seems to be working. So a big shout out to Frankie Lewington, who helped put the initial set of slides together.
I think it's the first time I've this time, too.
Good.
Very engaging.
And then, of course, trying to talk about what are we trying to achieve on these corridors. So we've used this slide to just point out this is not about building a bunch of projects. This is about getting people, able to arrive on time, knowing what to expect, having options. Some of these corridors go through people's main street, downtowns, their main streets, and we want them people to take pride in that place as opposed to feeling like it's just something that drives you past some shops. So that's all I have for today on regional investment strategy, unless you had any questions on transportation.
Questions?
Well, I think this is a great slideshow that really does explain to everybody what we mean by a corridor. And I think that it'll go a long way toward comforting Commissioner Rogers, when we're talking about, when we talk about a corridor, we're talking about an area where a lot of us converge in an area to get around. And it's always a challenge when you're talking to a group of people and you're using a phrase or a term like corridor, and then you want to talk about how good that is, but everyone in their mind has something else in their mind. And so doing something so that everybody's picturing the same thing when you say the word corridor, that in itself is a major accomplishment.
Good.
It isn't good this week.
We're good. Good job. Thanks. Legislative update?
Yes, absolutely. Randy is back down in Salem, and he has been busy. He testified yesterday on two, we would call them bad land use bills, that's just shorthand, two bills that were very interesting approaches to UGB expansions. One would require a local jurisdiction to expand their urban growth boundary if they essentially found impacts of gentrification. So it was an interesting combination of issues that have been very hot in Salem by a Republican legislator, not necessarily meant to be a helpful part of the dialogue. The other would have allowed UGB expansions to create workforce housing and workforce employment. And the definitions are so loose that
good.
The workforce.
I'll do that.
The workforce employment was really interesting. It was a very small footprint of building. So this is really interesting attempts.
Almost
to
sounds
grow.
Like inclusionary zoning and UGB expansion.
No, it sounds like a particular piece of property.
Hard to tell what they're really about. Bertschiger was one of the bills. They're both mostly out of Southern Oregon. So,
do they have any chance?
No, they're not going anywhere. But we need, it's one of those moments we need to get up and say, "Hang on a minute, let's separate out housing supply from land supply from infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera." Just want to make sure you were aware of that. Our household hazardous waste bill, HB 2772, passed out of its policy committee. It's on to Ways and Means, as we had hoped. And so now it goes into the maw of Ways and Means, and hopefully we can get it out the other side. But it goes dark for quite a while the budget gets examined and the chairs get instructions about what kind of resources they have. Our bill doesn't actually cost any new money. It has a cost assigned to it, but that cost can be covered by fees at DEQ. So because of that, it gets triggered that it has to go to Ways and Means. So we're hopeful that we can get it to come out the other side because it has no cost. It has to be high enough on the priority list. So we're feeling confident about that.
We'll be able to give input during that time?
Of course.
Ways and Means? Okay.
It's very different from a policy committee where they're really just considering the policy merits and then sending it along. Here, there's a prioritization process, and you got to get above the line in the Ways and Means process to get through. Having no actual cost helps a lot. But that all happens at the same time.
No state budget impact. It's something we could repeat over and over.
House Bill 2020, the carbon cap and invest, that we're awaiting amendments. So we're very close to having amendments come out. Many of our staff are involved in lots of conversations with various parties about the crafting of those amendments, and people are jockeying to get their piece. So far, we've been successful in having this MPO allocation and having funding devoted to places that have developed climate smart strategies. There are others trying to have the money spread out through with kind of formulaic process, the 50-30-20, or have it sent to ODOT with no connection to actual GHG reductions. So we're sort of more aligned with the environmental advocates around the dollar should be clearly targeted to things that have the impacts that you're charging the fee for in the first place. So we'll see where that sorts out, but lots of discussions with committee members, the governor's office, and others as they're trying to negotiate what's essentially the first round of real amendments. There'll be another opportunity, but it'd be good to make progress at this moment so that we can hold on to that progress as the bill moves along. What else? There is another, what we call a bad bill, on TNCs. It's a total local preemption, setting a statewide policy on TNCs, coming from some of our friends.
In
Uber, Lyft, those kinds of transportation network companies. Is that what that stands for? Thank you. So we are likely to sign into a bill the city of Portland is working on to oppose the flat-out preemption. There is another bill that Holvey is working on that would take a different approach. So we're trying to have conversations about getting some statewide policy that leaves local flexibility. I mean, even locally, the port and the city of Portland have different policies for Uber and Lyft at the different places, which has to do with insurance and safety and a whole variety of issues.
Those companies that operate to the airport, is that the...
Yes, yes. Correct. Yeah, what's happening in downtown, what's the weather rules versus who takes people to the airport, and what are the rules out there? The one area where we'd like clarification on position is HB 2509, which is the plastic bag ban. The base bill is good. It creates a statewide plastic ban on plastic bags. There are a couple set of amendments being bandied about, and this is where some clarification or backing up of position would be very helpful. Both sets of amendments propose a statewide fee, so a 10-cent fee on paper bags, but allow for or require a low-income exemption. And I think it would use the same kind of process the city, not the city of Portland. There's another city that already has a low-income exemption that if you use SNAP card or other thing like that, you're automatically exempted from the fees. There is a process that's been employed. You had directed us to seek a bag ban statewide without a preemption and with if there was some kind of fee structure that had no impact or limited impact on low-income families. So then the question, one set of amendments has a preemption language. So it says this is the statewide policy. We're banning plastic bags. We're establishing a 10-cent fee. And essentially local governments could have their own ordinance, but it couldn't be substantially different from that. The other amendment that's being brought forth by the League of Cities and some others would set a floor. So it'd say everyone has to have a 10-cent fee. You could charge more than that locally.
Have a 10-cent fee for a paper bag.
Yes, for a paper bag. All these ban single-use plastic bags and define what that means, so that that's clear and differentiates from the bag you put your lettuce in. But it's that bag with handles that you walk out with all your groceries in. That's banned in all these approaches. The question is the fee on paper bags, and if it's a preemption versus a floor. So we're really sort of seeking, our suggestion is that you direct us to continue supporting the ban, support the paper bag fee with low income exemption. And the question is, are you comfortable with preemptive language, or should we be seeking really some kind of floor as opposed to a flat out preemption? That's really the question on the table.
I think the city should have some flexibility. I just want to get rid of plastic bags. No. Is that setting the floor? Is that what you mean by establishing a floor?
We have some cities that don't have that won't let, like in Portland, they don't charge a fee.
City of Portland does not charge a fee. They are fine.
Does not allow retailers to charge a fee.
They don't require that a fee be charged for paper bags. Nothing precludes a retailer right now from charging for a paper bag. They seem to be fine with the policy of establishing a 10-cent statewide fee with a low-income exemption. So they don't seem to have that's the one place that we know of in our region where the state policy would override their existing policy in terms of the fee. Then the question is, are there other aspects of what a local government might want to do in the future that would be preempted by one approach versus not preempted because you're setting a floor on the basic policy, if that makes sense?
Well, a question, just clarify, and then a comment. Where does the 10 cents per bag go?
To the retailer.
To the retailer.
Yeah,
okay.
I mean it's an effort to get people to bring their own reusable bags. That's the idea.
And so then the added, what we would be preempting or not preempting the retailer or jurisdictions from capturing
jurisdiction.
More.
The jurisdiction.
From putting a requirement or from the jurisdiction actually capturing that money and taking that on into their government. I mean, what is it?
I don't know about the capturing the resource. I believe the 10 cent goes to the retailer, and the floor says if you have a local policy, it has to have at least a 10 cent fee on these bags. You could charge 15 cents or 12 and a half cents or, whatever, if you want to go above that. I can check on the question of where the fee money goes.
Well, for me, the issue is I would like not to have preemption and kind of more of a free market person in that case, even with the local jurisdictions being able to implement their own. But it's not so important to me that I would not support the alternative, which would be if there is a preemption.
Yeah.
So I'd still support, I have a preference, but I want it either way, if that makes sense.
My grocer doesn't charge you for the paper bag, but if you bring a cloth bag, you get a nickel discount. Or you can
donate, right.
Bag it forward and contribute it. So there's a lot of ways for retailers to approach this. I don't understand why you'd mandate a deposit if the retailer doesn't think they need it.
So we support the ban, seek a floor, make sure that if there's a fee, there's a low-income exemption. If we can't get the floor and they have to go with some preemption, we'd rather have the ban.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
I think I understand what you're saying, but I just want to get rid of plastic bags.
Right.
The rest of
sideshow.
Yes.
Reducing paper bags, I think, is significant. I think it's a helpful, and I also like that component. So I think it's a good one.
I think I'm getting head nods, and I think that
yep.
we can move that position forward. Okay.
I'm going to start as a nonprofit and seek grant funding to provide plastic or cloth bags at all grocery stores.
Craig's bags.
Craig's bags.
the last item I have is on.
Who does that? I carry a Metro bag and a Livable Communities bag and a something or other bag.
I'll give you a bag.
Oh, I've got bags.
But it's important to have bags.
I want everybody to have bags.
Because you don't want to.
All right.
You don't want to get into bag swag where you just throw waste in them and throwing those out.
I'm not recycling them. All right, moving on.
Last item is on the Commission with the Blind, just an update. We're in ongoing conversations with Kenny Geyer's office. You may have read in the paper she's been diagnosed with cancer, so she's out right now. But her office is committed to working with us to get language into a bill. In the meantime, we've also been in conversations with the governor's staff, who reached out to us about the issue. So there's ongoing dialogue about the exact right language to seek in a legislative fix, and that's where things stand.
Sorry, you jumped to subjects.
Yes.
Commission for the Blind.
And they're supporting the commission?
No. How do I paraphrase this? I understand at staff-to-staff level, we had a conversation, and it underscored there's a gulf in our understanding of what the purpose of the law initially was. So we are trying to fix what we think the purpose of the law was supposed to be, which is that it didn't apply to these venues that are using food as a way to raise revenue as part of their budget, but it applied to vending, and in some cases, food cafeteria services for employees in a building. And there seems to be a goal with the commission that's different than our understanding, and that has been the interpretation of what the law actually did.
Funding the good work of the commission by any means necessary.
Be that as it may, yes. I mean, I think Scott's argument would be they get no money if they take over the zoo vending because the zoo can't stay open anymore, and so it's not selling food anymore. So that doesn't create the public resource for the Commission for the Blind, would be our staff's argument.
Great, for about 2 months.
Yeah.
We had multiple conversations on this, so I think staff are just moving ahead on trying to get this finalized, right?
We just had a lot of questions on this, so keeping you posted, yes.
Yep. All right. Are you done?
So I have two items for Thursday, and Andy's actually the first one.
I have a question about Washington's legislation. Can I ask that now, and maybe you know the answer to this?
And the single
you can ask it, we might not know the answer to it.
So in the state of Washington, the legislature makes the decisions on transportation funding packages.
Oh.
And the governor put in that they would almost $3.2 million for an I-5 bridge replacement, and then another $300,000 for the Columbia River Bridge replacement at Hood River and White Salmon. And so if I believe they have passed, not nope. So
made it out of the Senate to the Senate floor, where it will probably die because Senator King. Who is the Republican ranking member on the committee, does not approve of the timing of this transportation package. And they need a 60% majority. It's not, yeah. They need the Republicans to vote for this in order for it to pass.
Okay, so
it's not
likely
this year.
Because the question there I have is that regarding the I-5, is hearing now Washington's moving forward, funding for to have a group focus on the I-5 bridge. Nothing's happening.
In a separate proposal made by the governor's office, that is moving. They have put in a request for $17 million to open back up the project office and start to finalize things so that we don't miss the deadline. Otherwise, we need to repay back the feds.
$100 million.
Yeah, and I think at that point, we will expect a governor's response from our side of the river, and then we can respond in kind as well.
Yes, it always is a discussion at the Southwest Washington Regional Transportation Council, so I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, everybody's very excited about the fact that it made it out of committee, but it's not...
It really hasn't gone anywhere.
Mm-hmm. It won't. Yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to cover two items that are on Thursday's agenda. The first one is the VFIGA amendment, and I left Andy up here since he's already here, so he could answer any questions you might have and just give you a brief overview of what this is and what this is not.
And what it is not.
So we're bringing you a resolution on Thursday that would authorize the Chief Operating Officer to agree to an amendment to the existing Visitor Facility Trust Account IGA. And this is what I lovingly call the mini amendment, although I'm told that's not technically correct. It's just an amendment.
It's not the big kahuna.
It's not the big kahuna, right. We can call that one the big kahuna when the time
not
comes.
Not even the kahuna.
You may recall last year we were involved in negotiations and discussions with the city and the county and Travel Portland about major revisions to the existing visitor facility trust account and the VFIGA. And we weren't able to get to completion of those by the end of 2018. But in discussions just before the holiday break, the chair and council president and mayor agreed to advance one of the items, which was a time-sensitive item. This is the funding for the Schnitzer acoustical shell replacement project. We needed a commitment by the end of the year in order to leverage private charitable contributions that are a significant portion of making that project happen. So the county actually proposed this, what I call mini amendment, be agreed to by all three parties by May of this year. And there was a letter of agreement between the three principals that was signed at that time to advance that and to be able to make the commitment to the private party. So that's what this is. Pretty straightforward, simple change to the existing IGA. The city has already acted. The signature, I think, was
electronic.
A moment of exuberance.
The county has not. When is the county scheduled to act?
The city acted in the first couple weeks of January, and I'm not clear when the county is yet set to act, but we set a date for ourselves of May, so we've got time. There's just a sort of budgeting question for OCC that's at issue here. So we've been asking the county to go ahead and get that scheduled, and in the meantime, there are staff and elected meetings beginning to talk about how do we re-up the conversation about the big kahuna, as it were, and getting to, hopefully getting to finalization on that. Yes.
So what you're telling us is this is not the big kahuna, which that I understand, but instead it's a small amendment for the $2 million for Schnitzer.
Correct.
Three. Okay,
correct.
And that's it.
Correct.
And we're voting on our resolution is to approve that this expense is okay. That the amendment.
You're voting to allow to direct the Chief Operating Officer to agree to an amendment.
You're actually amending the VDFIGA and having the council president sign it.
Oops, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. So the council is voting on the resolution so that the council president can sign it?
Yes.
All right.
Because it's an IGA, it has to be approved by the full governing body.
Each of us do this differently. The city does it by ordinance, and the county does it in an even different fashion. So...
All right, that's the first item for Thursday. Anybody else have any questions about this? I will say this project addresses an asset that really needs to be replaced for safety reasons. Yes, we're going to get a cool system, but the main thing is this project needs to move ahead because the existing orchestra shell isn't a safe piece of equipment any longer. The other thing I want to talk about, and I do want to make sure Nathan's paying attention to what I say, so so I'm going to call him out and embarrass him, unfortunately, in front of her. I didn't mean to do that, Nathan. I want to give you a quick overview of the solid waste rate-setting item, just because I think that, well, first of all, you're getting some correspondence on it. You're getting correspondence from one of our solid waste operators, and then it looks like that operator has managed to get John DiLorenzo to write you a letter on his behalf. And so a few years ago, for those of you who can go in the Wayback Machine, we changed when we adopt solid waste rates. We used to do it as part of the budget process. The problem with doing it that way is that the rates took effect essentially on October 1 instead of on July 1. And so it was tough actually for us to do the waste forecasting and the budgeting because we were operating for 75% of the year on the one set of rates and for a quarter of the year on the other set of rates. So you remember we moved rate setting up in advance of the budget process. Here's the good news about that. You guys have about 2 extra weeks in the process if you decide for any reason on Thursday after you heard the testimony that you want to delay second reading. My finance staff will be screaming at me for telling you that now, but if for any reason you think that you don't want to do second reading the following week, we have the option to come back and do an exec session with you and make sure that you're all up to speed and feel comfortable with moving ahead. There are 3 pieces that you probably ought to make sure you look at before Thursday. In addition to the staff report, Simon Williams, who's the finance manager who did the rate work, sent you all out a piece of email correspondence we get because you require us to get an independent analysis of whether the proposed rates meets certain criteria. So she sent on Friday the 8th of March an email that has an attachment from FCS. And if you don't have it, send me a quick email or have your policy advisor find it. It's just a 2-page document, which is our independent consultant giving us advice about whether the proposed rates meet our code-in criteria. Then you should have gotten the letter from Terrell Garrett, and then you should have gotten also on the Friday Tim's response and analysis to that. And then last but not least, and I don't know whether this went out to all of you, I'm going to double-check that, you probably got under the Metro Council dump box, you know, the one that the public emails, the letter from John DiLorenzo on Monday. And I know Nathan, John DiLorenzo, the guy who sues governments over rates, I know that Nathan and Council President Peterson are meeting to develop a strategy on that tomorrow. So all I'm trying to say is you can go ahead on Thursday with taking the testimony and then decide what you want to do.
I just realized what the confusion was earlier. We only get that mailbox once a week.
Yeah, you get it on Mondays, though, so you should have gotten it, and that's why I'm going to check and see what happens.
I've seen one, and it contained what Ernie was referring to, but it did not contain.
Okay, so I'm going to run down why you didn't get the letter and make sure you all get the letter, because you should have, but you didn't. And so let me not worry about how it screwed up.
I've never seen it. But I think Roger got it separately.
Okay. I think something happened with the Monday email that's supposed to go out. It didn't go out. I don't know why. It doesn't matter. What matters is that we get the letter in the hands of the counselors. I'll get that done this afternoon.
And if we could get the package of materials together that you talked about.
Sure.
If we don't.
I will also work with your CPCs to make sure you get a single packet.
Thank you. I hope so.
But the most important thing I want you to understand is you can read it, you can listen to the testimony, you can close the hearing, you can turn to Nathan and I and say, we want to have an exec session before second reading, or you can say we're comfortable, or you can say there's this other analysis or data we need, but let's go ahead with a public hearing. Okay. But we have time. All right. Nathan, is there anything you want to add about that? Other than if they have questions about the DLO letter, they should talk to you.
Yeah, I think just if you have any questions, set up a time to meet with me, meeting with Council President Peterson tomorrow, and we're going to talk about it. I think we feel fairly comfortable in our position. So, but I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any once you review the letter. So.
Okay. Thanks. Is that it?
I think that's enough.
Yes. Thank you. Councilor Communications. Wow. Okay, Craig Durson.
I've got a couple of things. On last Friday, the pilot program committee met. As a reminder, the pilot program is Partnerships and Innovative Learning Opportunities in Transportation, pilot, which means how do we address emerging technologies? How do we work them to our advantage? And we solicited for proposals from the region, from organizations that had an idea of how you could, they could do a pilot project to see how we could utilize things like rideshare and card share and apps and things like that to make transportation work better. So we met together and reviewed the projects that had been evaluated by staff, and there were several that actually didn't meet the requirements. So we eliminated those and looked at the rest, listened to staff recommendation, had a very robust discussion. And there wasn't complete agreement in the room, but we were able to come to a consensus compromise, I'll put it that way. And so we've got the recommendation that we're going to put forward, and I won't tell you what that is because I don't want to steal Elliot Rose's thunder when he comes and gives the presentation, and he'll do a much better job than I anyway. So, but we did have that meeting, and that did happen. And then Monday morning, yesterday morning, the Southwest Corridor Steering Committee met, TriMet Southwest Corridor Steering Committee met, and at the previous days or that same week, they had a community meeting in Southwest about the two issues that still arise around the locally preferred alternative, the actual alignment, and they had so many people sign up to speak that they were not able to get through them all, and so we set aside a portion of our agenda to listen to the rest, and that was 38 people. We spent the first hour listening to a testimony, and it was primarily about the Bonita to Bridgeport. Yeah, almost completely, in fact.
Oh, yeah. Of course, the restaurant.
Yeah, actually, that.
In favor or in opposition?
There are multiple options, and it was people speaking primarily in opposition to a specific proposal. So, yeah. But we did take an action as well on the crossroads. We selected the B2 option. There were several different options on, if you know what I mean, the crossroads. It's where
Barber Transit Station.
Yes, where Barber is, where I-5, Barber Boulevard, and Capitol Highway all cross in one place, multiple levels. And it's very complicated, and there were several different options, and finally evaluated them, and based on cost and efficiency and impact on community, chose the B2 option, which is the one that it goes from the center of Barber and then cuts behind the Barber Transit Center, so between the it'll go between the Barber Transit Center and Interstate 5, and then cross I-5 and Barber Boulevard in one fell swoop and drop onto the other side. We initially thought that was going to be more expensive than going the other way, because then you only have to cross I-5. But because of getting up the hill and around turned out to be a challenge, the cost was comparable either way. And so the way that we've chosen, there's less community impact, less neighborhood impact. It'll be pretty dramatic when it's done also.
So that
decision was made. Yeah.
Will the lights change color? Will there be a light display?
There's no lights on the ramp that comes up from like Tillicum to.
Could be distracting for people on Barber if there was. Yeah.
There's no river below this.
So those two things were my. That was my report.
Cool. Good.
I do have a communication. The Division Transit Project open house, there were two of them last week, one at Portland Community College and the second one in Gresham at Gresham City Hall. I wasn't able to attend the PCC one, but at Gresham. The staff sound really hopeful that they'll soon hear about funding the project, and they think it's looking pretty good. So I was frankly surprised, based on the current administration in our federal government. So we'll see. Famous last words. We won't know it officially happens until we have the check. But.
Let's not tweet about it.
No.
Please.
I have a few updates. This morning, Andy and I presented at the Washington County Commission for T2020 and the Regional Investment Strategy. I'd say it went pretty well. I also presented at CPO 7 last night, which is North Bethany and Bethany, which is, explains my perspective for urban unincorporated Washington County. So I'm really grateful that I went to that. I also went to the Cornelius Library soft opening last week, and we invested $600,000 in that, $500,000 TOD, and $100,000 of Nature Neighborhood capital grants to build a patio. And it looks incredible. The hard opening, or I guess the grand opening, is the 28th or the 30th, somewhere between that. So y'all are invited to come to my hometown. For the most needy update I have, though, is the ODOT policy group that Margie and I went to on Friday. And my, oh my.
There you go.
All right, it's just us, so I can just be candid. Yeah, it was a lot. Travis chaired the meeting, and Margie and I, on our way back, we kind of agreed that he had a very heavy-handed, kind of condescending approach towards the Metro. Surprise, surprise. We covered the following topics: HB 2017 and some of the sub projects. Safe Routes to School was a part of that. We talked about design speeds and some of the work that ODOT is doing with the City of Portland, I think on Powell. It's just a positive report overall. Cap and Invest, this is where it got openly really awkward, because Travis decided to dictate who would speak and in what order. So he went to AOC, LOC, and he's like, "Oh, hey, Metro, aren't you guys interested in this?" So he basically asked AOC to speak first, and they were just in line with ODOT. They were really aggressive about 50-30-20. And then LOC, the mayor of Prineville, said outright that he doesn't even believe Cap and Invest should be a bill. So off the bat, we were playing pretty hard defense, because they gave some pretty hard statements, I guess, to ODOT. I'm not really sure how effective, I mean, Metro's presence is there. I think they just kind of like, "Oh, hey, Metro, good for you." But I guess we'll see.
Sorry, I couldn't be there.
I tried to respond as assertively as I could. Obviously saying that we have concerns about 50-30-20, thinking that it should instead be invested in climate smart as a climate reduction strategy. 2014 mandated by the state, it's there. The principles are there. Our implementing partners are there. We think it should go to that. And the head guy of AOC got really like squirmy, so it was kind of cool.
Good job.
Thank you, sir. He got really red. I liked it. Another issue that we talked about was jurisdictional transfer. That was another thing that ODOT was kind of, I can't speak for all of ODOT, but Travis just made a lot of sly like comments and kind of offhand jokes that Margie and I didn't appreciate. But essentially, I'm not sure if this is ODOT's exact position, but, you know, Travis made a joke, and he's saying, "Oh, well, you know, Metro is going to pay for all of the transfers with T2020, right?" So I don't think that's necessarily our approach.
It's not a joke.
No. I mean, so, and he said this out loud. So if he's saying this, I can only imagine what they're saying when we're not in the room. So we talked about that. We presented on T2020. There was another issue. With jurisdictional transfer, they made it seem too. They made AOC and LOC present, and they made it seem like it was just the Portland Metro issue. So they're like, "Oh, well, it seems that only really Metro cares about it, so we're not going to talk about it unless you have anything to say."
What's interesting, though, is I worked a jurisdictional transfer down in District 4, and it was not a problem.
No.
It's really the problem, or Region 4, sorry. It's a problem. It's an issue statewide, but it's only a problem in Region 1.
Yeah. And then I presented on T2020. Overall, it went very well. AOC Bro, who Margie and I, we refer to him as that, the head lobbyist for AOC. I don't even know who he was. I can't remember. I was fuming. Mike, there you go. Yeah, that guy. He and Travis were being pretty aggressive against Margie, so she was so graceful, and I'm so grateful she's on our team. But overall, I walked away feeling like this policy group in general felt really shady. I don't really know what the point of it is. Does ODOT even give a crap about what we have to say? Their stakeholders feel very handpicked to kind of reinforce their values and their perspective. So although I don't have a strong technical transportation, obviously background, definitely tried to lead as much as I could with the values and the outcomes that we would want to see. And so that's how that went. I'll let you know how the next meeting goes, and I know Craig will be there, so thank you.
My intent is to be there because I represent the MPOs on that committee.
My good sir.
Double played.
Right.
I just sent a text to Tammy Maney because she would like to take over that policy group for the OTC to have control over that.
Yeah.
So I just sent
Travis never asked, I can't remember her name. I don't know if Tammy was on the call or not, but he never deferred to Tammy. He never deferred to Matt. He just kind of, went ahead and spoke on behalf of the agency. So I was like, okay, I don't know really what to.
On a similar topic, the Rose Quarter project hearings are underway, and so I went to open house last week and just kind of viewed some of the presentations there. A lot of turnout, and I was there, after we had meetings here. I was there very late, and there were still a lot of people there, and it was far less than had been there. The next opportunity is for folks to testify tonight. That starts at 4:30 across the street. I expect a large contingency there, and including folks from Tubman Middle School, and everybody has 2 minutes to testify, and they're giving electeds opportunity to testify up front. So I plan to take advantage of that, but testifying on behalf of myself and District 5. So we'll share a little bit about as a reminder about the history of this area and the importance of serving the community in this area, the importance of this area to the region in terms of not just being a place to get cars through, but a place for really making sure that as we're doing this work, we are creating jobs for the folks who really need jobs, that we are focusing on what kind of air quality and emissions, addressing air quality emissions challenges. If we are not going to have an environmental impact statement, that we ought to be making sure that we are doing everything we can to mitigate environmental effects. Anyway, I'll be
Are you doing anything to say not preclude the Albina Vision from happening?
Yes, I will make sure. I have been talking about that, to which I think there's a lot of dismissiveness there.
Yes,
in terms
doesn't.
Of,
yes.
Who is that? We started our visioning 10 years ago, and,
Yeah.
So... That we don't need to worry about that. We just need to get our statements out there. So,
yeah.
That's what my plan is. Anybody would be welcome to, of course, do that, but I will be there.
Interestingly enough, Commissioner Scoutin from Washington County attended, I think, one of the open houses yesterday, and he just pivoted to, it seems Portland doesn't want this. That's a lot of money. Washington County could use $500 million. So, that was interesting.
Well, there are a lot of ideas about how to spend the $500 million.
Was he talking about the Rose Quarter?
Yeah.
He's just making the logical projection. It's gone up $100 million since the legislature authorized $400 million. So by the time they're actually building, it'll be at least a billion.
No, I think he's saying if you guys don't want this money, we'd be happy to.
Yes, that's essentially what he said.
But the thing I said of the $500 million, I think, is also wry.
But I don't know that it's, unless it has elements that are serving Portland, it's really not a Portland project. Yes, some people will be, local users of it, but if it's just a project to get people through Portland, that's not a Portland project.
Right. Yep. Yeah, I'm surprised he said that. That's why I'm, traditionally would support.
Especially when it's not meeting the vision.
He makes it a Portland project is because there's other opportunities there to improve the neighborhood as well.
Yeah.
Well, that, hopefully. Yeah. Well, I think that's the point.
Yeah. Right.
I've noticed that the activists and the urbanists, the no freeway people tend to ignore some of the other multimodal investments that the Rose Quarter, you know, is obviously supporting, and the LID, and the Albina Vision with a tunnel LID, whatever that is.
The TLID.
The TLID?
The LID.
The LID Plus? Plus?
Yeah, it's a LID.
So, curious to see. I would love to hear how it goes.
All right. Thank you, everybody. You're adjourned.